Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have someone well known to First Things readers, Wilfred McClay. Professor McClay is the Blankenship Chair in the History of Liberty at the University of Oklahoma. He is the author of many works, including the important book from the history book from the 90s called The Masterless, Self and Society in Modern America, and just recently, the topic for our talk today, a book called Land of Hope, An Invitation to the Great American Story. Welcome, Professor McClay.
Thank you, Mark. It's wonderful to be with you.
So you want to describe the book right off the bat? This 450-page book?
It's a little book compared to what one could write. No, I'm very conscious of all the ways I've had to shorten things, but I wanted to produce a sort of single soup to nuts American history that would be accessible to all. I think particularly I want it to be accessible to young people. If I have a target audience, it would be young people who are about to take the advanced placement exam or in U.S. history or are in that sort of bracket. But I can see college students reading it, and I can see general readers reading it. It really is an attempt to tell the American story in a narrative, as much of a narrative form as possible, so that it is a story.
Well, it's interesting. I think the word story here is a loaded term in a very good way, in that you're talking about the story. You know, we used to see a lot of books about American culture, such as, you know, an important textbook in the mid-20th century about American literature would be the story of American literature, and that it would be a story in that you would sort of have a series of authors, of works, of events, of historical personages that did give you a narrative and tell you the course of America through, often with some kind of plot to it, that would carry you through. And the more it was a compelling story, the more you wanted to find out more about it. That the story element was actually a big part of people acquiring knowledge. You know, you retain facts better when they can be placed in a good story.
Absolutely. I mean, that it, otherwise everything is sort of disconnected, and there is a lack of a web of meaning into which factoids can be placed, and so that I think a lot of what particularly now young people learn is sort of the decontextualized knowledge of America's failings without any larger context. And some of that larger context I can't supply. That is the comparative dimension.
That's an important point that you say. There is, the revisionist history, right, of America that does tend to strive so hard against any form of myth-making, against American exceptionalism, but they don't give you a counter story. They emphasize other things, often to the detriment to American reputation, imperialism, slavery, and the rest, but they don't give it as a story.
No, and I think when you do tell it as a story, you have one of two choices. You can either make it a kind of melodrama in which the American past is really nothing but a kind of villainy, or you can make it into the story of flawed individuals doing the best that they can and often doing very great things. Accomplishing very great things against odds, even with their imperfections. Thomas Jefferson was a great man. Thomas Jefferson had great flaws. Get used to it. That's the way life is. It's this mixed bag. It's not a melodrama. It's not a triumphalist story out of the Bible either. It's a mixed bag always. And I think part of teaching young people, as I'm always thinking about, but it's older people too, trying to get them to think historically, means thinking your way into the circumstances of the past and trying as best you can to enter sympathetically into the consciousness and circumstances of people in the past. If I could add one other thing too here that goes with narrative, and that is membership, that this is our country. Like it or not, or weigh it more heavily or more lightly on the scales of justice, it is your country, and it's incumbent on you as really an act of self-knowledge to know as much as you can about it and to enjoy the privileges and responsibilities of citizenship in the fullest sense of the term.
And the story is still going, and you're in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're in it. This is your story, and it's happening. It's happening today. And if they're not involved, if they don't see that the U.S. history is culminating in you, no wonder we get test scores in areas of history that are so abysmal. I mean, you know, the National Association or National Assessment of Educational Progress. It's done by the federal government, and it's our, quote, nation's report card. They do the subject texts. They don't just do math and reading. They also do a test in U.S. history. And as you know, 12th graders who take that test every single time they take it, it's about every 3 or 4 years 12th graders take it, they score below basic. And that's the lowest score. That's an F. And more than 50% of high school 17-year-olds score below basic every time they give that in U.S. history. And they've just taken a course in U.S. history. What happened? It's not being retained.
Yeah. And, I think here the problem is a mixture of political and other considerations. I think one of the problem, I think, stems from the top down, that we look to academic historians, people like me, to sort of set the tone for the discipline to represent the latest and best of what's going on. And I don't think we're doing that. You don't see narrative histories of the United States being published. There's no professional gain in it. Nobody really wants to hear those things or see them expressed in a fresh way.
Why is that?
Well, all the incentives for advancement, and I think it's just as true in your field of literary studies, is all the incentives are for highly professional, highly critique and highly professional, specialized, miniaturized studies of this and that, but often revisionist in some way, showing that, well, Benjamin Franklin wasn't really such a great guy after all, showing that yet another exegesis of why the Constitution was really a pro-slavery document. And these are all really, I think people in the academy don't think about, what can I do with this as an American citizen? What do I do with this? After such knowledge, what forgiveness?
tenure.
Tenure. But it's, I think, one of the things that we've done, and as the professional historians, is we've simply abdicated our responsibility to the public. So I think it's, and there's two aspects of that that are troubling. One is that we're not giving the public the benefit of what we know. People do have a lot of misconceptions, some of which are more favorable to the country's history than they should be. I think that's absolutely true. But the other thing that is an unfortunate side effect of that lack of contact with the public is that we don't learn from them. What we're not listening to them, to what they need. Because after all, the history does not belong to the historians. It is not the possession of the historians. We don't ultimately have the right to say, well, now this is history because it's got my good housekeeping seal of approval stamped on it. Ultimately, the history is something that belongs to all of us. So the public, what the public needs to know And part of what they need to know is important. Part of what we need to know is what you call this mythic dimension. And mythic not in the sense of a falsehood, not in the sense of a noble lie, but mythic in the sense that that is when we say all men are created equal. Is that a myth? Well, in a sense, it is. I mean, we know perfectly well. LeBron James and I do not have equal talents when it comes to basketball. I mean, we're not even in the same continent when it comes to that. I can use many other examples to my disfavor, but we do mean something by equality, both as a kind of ascriptive thing and also as an aspiration to have a society that recognizes our equality in the eyes of God more fully in the actualities of our political, social, legal life. But to simply say right here, right now, July 4, 1776, all men are equal. Well, you know, or created equal even. Does a Down syndrome child have equality with me? Well, in one sense, yes, as Christians, we believe that. But in another sense, and even in a civic sense, perhaps, not necessarily, you know, all depends on, you know, factors that really we don't have time to go into. But the mythic dimension, the mythic dimension of American history, the aspirations of American history, what I try to capture in the title of my book, which is A Land of Hope, that's, I think, the important thing that needs to be conveyed. And, you know, I think, well, on the one hand, I think teaching children, you know, you're in America, so you can grow up to be anything. You know, I've had some reservations of that. That goes against, that appeals to a certain kind of narcissism that young people need to be disabused of. But to say that this is a country that uniquely among countries in the history of the world has been built around the idea that no one should be imprisoned by the conditions of their birth, that everyone should be able to be better, to improve their lot, that the conditions
that sounds pretty
which
exceptional
we're born,
to me.
Yeah. Well, I don't know a lot of other places where that's the sort of norm. I'd be happy to consider them if people would present them to me. But and that doesn't mean we don't have a class system of sorts. That doesn't mean that it's very difficult to rise in the world, and very easy to sink. You know, that's part of the story of America too. And one of the things I repeatedly point out in the book is that to be a land of hope does not necessarily mean that everybody succeeds. To be a land of hope is also to be a land of disappointed hopes, to claim great things as your goals, and to fail in realizing those goals perfectly is that it can be a bitter pill to swallow. But would you rather have that than a nation that didn't strive at all, that didn't hold itself to the standards that we hold ourselves to and often fall short of? That's a very different thing. So the Land of Hope title is not, it's neither straightforward nor ironic. I think it is descriptive that you cannot understand what America is if you only look at the material facts and simply deduce from them what the texture of life in the nation is. You can't approach this as a Marxist. You have to start with the superstructure and move down to the base to really understand America.
You say in the preface that you, quote, have chosen to emphasize the political history of the United States at every turn. Does that mean you're shortchanging cultural, military, and so on?
Well, I would actually include military in that, and diplomatic history and all of that as elements of political history. Actually, really, I think my target there is social history. That for most of my professional life, social history has been the preferred mode of historical analysis among the professional historians. And there's a lot of good things to be said about social history.
And social history for our listeners, social history is?
Oh, well, social history is looking at history primarily through the development of social groups, that is ethnic groups, you know, emphasis on cultural formations in the cultural in the anthropological sense rather than the sort of prescriptive sense of culture, and seeing historical development primarily through that lens. It's a way of getting non-elite people into the narrative, which I think is very important. But as I say in the book, you can't do everything at once, and you have to have a framework. You have to have the skeleton of the story before you can have the whole body. So, again, in line with my desire to have a book that somebody is compact enough that somebody might actually want to pick it up and read it, I did make the choice to concentrate on political history, because that I think that's the indispensable framework. After all, if you're going to write a history of a nation is first and foremost a political entity. So you need to structure your account on the basis, the framework provided by the political history of the nation. So the things like debates over the Constitution, the whole process by which the Constitution was arrived at, this is absolutely central for me. I think every American citizen should know that story and understand why we have the Constitution we have, which is actually very difficult to understand if you don't place it in the historical context of the flow of events, going all the way back to the beginnings of British North America, and even before, really. That's what will tell you why a document that creating a national government that was in many ways systemically at odds with itself, separation of powers, checks and balances, a relationship into a federal system that counters the national government against the states, that the concentration of power was not just through ideological principle, but through hard historical experience, was deemed to be a very great danger. And don't we see it now? Why should people, suddenly people on the left are discovering, wow, you know, having all this concentration of power in the presidency, which was really okay 2 years ago, is now no longer okay. Well, you know, let's be consistent. It's always a problem to have too much concentration of power, no matter what party holds power. That's what the framers of the Constitution understood. So I want people to read the book, young people particularly, to understand there's a reason why we have this bulky, difficult mechanism. And it might do even better if we could thin out some elements of the administrative state that the progressives added.
If you had an episode in that you cover in American history where you are pressing for readers, let's say high school seniors in a class, is there one area where you really depart from the consensus academic presentation of that episode?
Well, I do often, but I also do it. I think it's the responsible thing to do, again, thinking of myself as a teacher, to let students know that there are a lot of different views about this, about the causes of the Depression, for example. But I do say I open the chapter about Hoover and the New Deal, the coming of the New Deal, Roosevelt, by saying, you know, what if Calvin Coolidge had been president at this time? What would have happened? What would he have done? How would the outcome have been different? And I think. Readers who are open-minded may well be led to the conclusion, wouldn't it be nice if we could go back and see if the growth of a gigantic administrative bureaucracy in Washington, which has not gone away, even in instances when it Well, we did get rid of the NRA, but the instance where it has been ineffective, I'm not sure I really depart, by the way, and from the view of most historians. I think most historians will concede, even if they mutter it under their breath, that the New Deal really didn't do much to solve the economics of the problems of the Depression. It took the war to do that. And some will then go on to argue, well, that's because the war authorized a truly Keynesian level of deficit spending that wasn't possible in peacetime. And, you know, that's an argument worth having. But you can't argue on the basis of what actually happened that Roosevelt's economic policies were. You can even argue that things like the Social Security Act pulled money out of circulation and thus led to what was called at the time the Roosevelt Recession. I make sure my readers know about these things, and I'm not trying to push Milton Friedman's understanding or anybody else's. One of the things I do repeatedly is to say, like, for something like the origins of the First World War, is to say, look, people are still, it's been a century now since the end of the First World War, and there's still not a complete consensus about the reasons for the origins of the war. And here you have the single most transformative event, arguably, in the history of the West that really, in some sense, we've never gotten over. I mean, we in the West have never gotten over the First World War. Way of seeing the last 100 years is as a kind of struggling to take the measure of something so catastrophic coming in the at a moment when Western civilization seemed to be at its pinnacle. And the method in my madness is that I want people who read this book to think that history is not just an inert record of facts in which the science, so to speak, is settled, that it is a reflective activity. It's something that goes to our deepest nature, as story making and meaning finding creatures, that we're constantly drawn to go back and rethink the past and try to extract more and more meaning out of it, to ask new questions of the past, questions that wouldn't occur to us at the time. And that history is a reflective art. It is something that goes to the very depths of our beings, and that we should understand that it's not an answer man book that you go to and say, okay, well, this tells us, history tells us. That is, I think history has a lot to teach us, but, you know, the sort of glib history tells us that whenever you hear that, you can pretty much turn your hearing aid down, because what you're going to be hearing coming next is whatever you know that person already believes.
You know, on World War One, Edith Wharton, in her memoir, A Backward Glance, talks about growing up in New York City. And she was part of the very, very high elite, Edith Jones, super wealthy. And she talked about it as a sequence of just super civilization, propriety, decorum, rules of etiquette, protocols all the time. She felt like all of us young ones were being watched constantly to see if we were observing the canons of civilization. And he said, and she said, all of that ended in August 1914.
Mm-hmm.
It was the end of one kind of, you couldn't uphold civilization.
It's the end of one kind of authority, of cultural, civic, political, legal, everything, social authority. Yeah, we're still struggling with that in all sorts of ways, partly because we've gotten into the anti-authoritarian habit, and partly because our elites are not really
They don't believe in themselves.
They don't believe in themselves. They're not really worthy of our obedience. if I may say something a little radical here.
That sounds rather American.
Well, rather American. And, you know, my first book that you mentioned, The Masterless, is really about this sort of dualism in American life of the longing to be free and the longing to belong. And of course, the American way is to be longing to be part of something in which you're free. it's the combination of those things, and it sounds paradoxical, but it's actually not unachievable.
This is why how many of our mythical cultural figures are these sort of odd, you know, free characters from Walt Whitman's Song of the Open Road, or Huck Finn, got to light out for the territory, or even all the way through, you know, when European, well, when we saw, remember the film Easy Rider, we see that as this countercultural, semi-sociopathic presentation, but I was told that Europeans looked at those guys, thought, well, those are Americans. They're out there. They're wanderers. They're vagabonds. He's wearing a motorcycle helmet that's an American flag, the Peter Honda character there, and that this was pure Americanism. If you take away all the drug stuff from it, that desire to break out and to go into the unknown and not to be rooted too much anywhere, or rooted in some strange spiritual America. That's America.
It is, and I have a bit of an ode to Walt Whitman in the book, which may surprise some people. But I think that is a part of America. It's part, not just a part of the way we're perceived, but a part of the way we are. But it's definitely a part of the way we're perceived. I two quick stories. I taught as a Fulbright professor in Rome a number of years back, and wonderful experience. And I had one of my favorite students was a guy who studied American literature, and his email address I still remember was I shouldn't give the domain name, but it was Walt Sings at whatever. He loved Walt Whitman. It was and loved America sort of through Walt Whitman. And the other thing was I met my local coffee shop in my neighborhood. I met a guy who it turned out was an architect. And I was always curious. He would always come up in his black motorcycle, you know, typical Italian motorini with these big, long, you know, tubes. And he'd come into the coffee shop and lay out the blueprints that he was working on. Finally, I struck up a relationship with him. And he was I found out he was an architect. And we got to talking. And he finally said, "Why are you here?" And I said, "What do you mean, why am I here? Why wouldn't anybody be here in Rome?" And they said, "Well, tell me why." And so I gave the typical answer about how Rome is, you know, the eternal city, and that you have this great experience of, for me, part of it is this experience of sort of walking through time, that you see this magnificent jumble of buildings and artifacts and things from all different ages, many of which are still rooted as they were, or ruins of what they were, and all juxtaposed, and he kind of just nodded at me like, yeah, I've heard all of this. And I said, "Well, where do you want to go?" And he says, "I want to go to America." I said, "Well, where do you want to go in America?" And I thought he'd say New York or Boston. He said Las Vegas, and he was serious, because the whole Western interior, which makes up much of the landscape in Easy Rider, was of limitlessness, or at least of possibility.
No, I've heard Europeans say that too. They want to drive around the West.
Yeah. And that's another way of thinking about what it means to be a land of hope, is to be the land of the open road, of Whitman's open road. I'm a conservative, you know, but I also love that about America, and would fight, you know, fiercely against those who would sort of erase that from our national character. That kind of and it can be rebellious. It can be just merely aspirational, and you know, kind of a tremendous openness to to possibility. And you know, that's a part of what we are. That is a part of why the frontier, despite all the brickbats that have been thrown at Frederick Jackson Turner for his great essay on the frontier's role in American history, in a mythic way, he had it right, that we are, you are shaped by the sense of being a frontier people in some very important ways. And that that's why JFK ran for president on a platform of the new frontier. We needed it. Space was to be a new frontier. And, you know, this is something we may well recover. I mean, there's a growing sense in the country, I think, that the exploration of space is something we ought to get back to, because that's part of who we are, part of what we are.
Professor McClay, thank you for joining us. The book is ideal for high school, you know, juniors and seniors, and I think first, second year college students as well. It's in Counter Books.
Counter Books, yes. I wanted, and it is, I'm not absolutely sure about the price. Last I knew it was $29, so it's a real bargain, and it's beautifully produced.
Well, let's put it in context. Most American history textbooks are up $100.
Oh, yeah, at least, yeah. It's a beautiful book. We have lots of nice maps and illustrations with witty captions. I hope they're witty. I want to emphasize that this is I have targeted this in some ways for high schoolers, but I think it's going to find an audience among people like the readers of First Things. And I hope so. And there's a lot about religion in here that you don't find in American history textbooks. I think Richard Newhouse would have approved of the book. I hope Rusty Reno approves of it.
I approve of it.
Well, good. So. That's all that matters. That's all that
matters. Very good. All right. Thank you, Professor McClay.
Thank you very much.